You can't build a business through a playbook. You can't just ABC, got to go talk to this many customers and do this and get the feedback. It doesn't work like that. But you need to talk to enough of them to get enough signal before you get to noise.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. The Entrepreneur Experiment breaks down the secrets and systems world-class founders use to build their business, their body, and their brain. Today, we're talking to Ian Brown, who's the Managing Director of NDRC, the National Digital Research Centre, based in Dogpatch Labs here in Dublin. Basically, he's the guy that is charged with making Ireland the best place in the world to start a company. He runs multiple accelerators, and he's also a serial entrepreneur himself. He started and exited his own company, which makes him a master of both worlds. Here's my chat with Ian Brown. Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, point of sale, e-commerce, inventory management, chatting endlessly about the weather. Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from my Connick offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of Connick offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Connick offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials from my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day, bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Connick offices. One of the most frequent questions I get asked on this podcast is, where do I find a mentor? And I've never fully had the answer, but now I do. Introducing Mentors Work, a fully funded mentoring program designed to help your business thrive, brought to you by the Small Firms Association in partnership with Skillnet Ireland. Imagine having a series of one-to-one individual mentoring sessions, along with upskilling workshops to network with your peers and learn from experts, as well as a bespoke business plan. And the best part, it's at no cost to you. Join over 2,000 Irish SMEs and see how the award-winning Mentors Work program can help your business to thrive. Places are limited though, so apply today at mentorswork.ie. Program is fully funded until the end of 2023, so get your application in now. Ian, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
A very special journey down from Belfast just for us.
Especially for you today, yes.
We feel very, very special. Thank you. Ian, what do you do?
I am currently Managing Director of the NDRC, which is the National Digital Research Centre based out of Dogpatch Labs here in Dublin.
After the end of every season, I always ask people for feedback. And they're like, sometimes you forget to ask people what the hell they do. And I'm 10 minutes in before I realise what we're talking about. I was like, good feedback. Well, I ask people.
You asked me that and I forgot what I did for a minute.
It is the hardest question. And I said it to everybody because they're like, and I literally said to the previous guest as well, because he was like, I do this. And I'm like, yep, it's the hardest question.
Yeah.
It's all downhill from here. What is that? Like, what is NDRC? What is Dogpatch for people? Like, I'm extremely familiar with it because I'm in the startup scene, but people are not in the startup scene. What is that?
And let me start with Dogpatch before NDRC, because that's kind of where that particular story starts. And like, Dogpatch was set up, and I'm probably going to get the dates wrong, but like about 6 years ago, but by Patrick Walsh. And that's just, it started off as a co-working space. It's somewhere for like founders to get together and like hot desk and try and build stuff. And which was going quite well. Like, it was kind of good. It was getting a good vibe going, but then COVID hit. And obviously that was pretty difficult for all co-working spaces everywhere. But Patrick was like, no, we need to do more to support founders. And so he actually then was like, we're going to reshape what NDRC is. Because it's been going for a long time, like 15 years or something like that. And it's like a government-backed program that's supposed to help founders from all across Ireland, like right from the idea stage right up to kind of Series A. It was felt that maybe there needed to be more of a kind of global lens put on this and kind of building stuff to a really, really high standard, and we should hold ourselves to that higher standard. Mm. So that was kind of what it set out at the start to do that. And what happened was that Dogpatch then got together with the Republic of Work from Cork, the RDI Hub in Kerry, and the Porter Shadow Galway, and they came up with a sort of all Ireland approach to this, where it became like a connected set of hubs that were there to provide support and investment to founders at the early stages.
I think that's the key, isn't it? Because Dublin kind of sucks everything in, sucks talent, and that used to work, didn't work, but that was used to be how the world works, because you physically had to be there. Mm-hmm. I think the world we find ourselves in now, whereby people can quite happily work from Galway, Mayo, Tipperary, Belfast, wherever it is, but yet still feel connected. I think that's the key part that was missing for a long time.
Yeah, I think the connection, there's two things that founders need, when they're kind of starting a company, and one is capital, and the other is skills. But I kind of define skills a bit like network. So actually, you have to be able to plug yourself in to get the things that you don't currently have. And I think if you can, if you're a founder building in Galway, just by, population size, you don't have as many people as you can talk to there, right? But if you plug into a much bigger network, and Dublin's great and it's big, but it's not London, it's not New York, it's not San Francisco. So it's you have to be able to plug yourself into bigger networks. And this is just kind of taking the kind of, almost the Russian doll approach, kind of small, bigger, beer, and trying to connect everything together just to help founders from all across the country. I think it's working pretty well. We're starting to see more activity certainly coming from regions around Ireland, which is great from my perspective, and I think good for Ireland's perspective as well, and more opportunities for everyone. So far, it's still early days. We've only, Dogpatch has only been, and the regional partners have only been involved in this for 2 years now, I think it is. But early signs are good.
It's a big impact in 2 years. You were kind of asking me earlier about my impressions of Dogpatch and DRC, and it's just blown up in terms of, you seem to be, you've hoovered up an incredible amount of talent, you've hoovered up an incredible amount of founders, great companies are now coming through there, being attached and then catapulting forward. You've done a really good job in a very short space of time. You mentioned there about, the regional hubs and stuff. I'm a big believer in, you're the sum of the five people you're around the most. If you only see a certain level, you think that's where the limit is.
Yep.
You turn the dial up to five and you're like, I'm at the max level. And then we talked about travel earlier, you go to Manchester, London, New York, you're like, oh, the dial goes up to 50. 100%. There's a whole other thing that I actually didn't turn past. And you're like, okay, now there's a new target. Now there's a new goal. How do we do that though? How do we bring that bigger thinking here? Because you can't keep traveling all the time, because you can't keep topping up those reserves. How do we bring that thinking here?
So I think there's definitely a cultural aspect to that. One of the ways that I found particularly useful was I did a bunch of work with early stage founders in Northern Ireland for a while before coming down to work with Dogpatch. And we used to take 10 founders out to the US every year. And the sole purpose of that was just to demystify everything. It wasn't like we're going to go out and raise money, we're going to lose customers. No. Yeah. Yes, we get to meet some investors, but yes, we get to meet some founders. But it was more just to realize that actually people are running the same playbook. They're reading the same things you're reading. They're doing the same things you're doing. But the level of ambition was, a 10x time higher than what we had here. And that sort of helped raise the ambition level of everyone here. But not only did it help raise the ambition level of the 10 people who went out there, that percolates, right? And so that kind of goes to, they speak to other founders, that starts to do that. So I think continuing to travel is important. Everyone doesn't have to travel, but I think I personally do, right? Mm-hmm. I find myself getting I don't want to say more parochial, but certainly getting a bit more closed-minded, unless I kind of remember to expose myself to the world, right? So I will make trips to London just for no particular purpose, apart from just to be exposed to a bigger scale of something and a higher level of ambition than maybe I see around me every day.
It's so easy to do now. We talked about this earlier about, I go to Manchester all the time.
Yep.
Yeah, I go to see United play, but when I go there, like yourself, I just wander around the city with no real agenda, which is great. I just come back energized, just come back a different lens for a few weeks. And obviously, you got to top that up again. How did you get involved in all this?
I guess, first of all, as a founder, so, and that's probably one of the things that helps me right now and helps me dealing with founders on a daily basis is that I kind of have been through some of the things that people have been through before. And so, you know, I'll not take you way back to the start, but like I was living and working in London in big pharma actually, but within like kind of the informatics space. So kind of it was a largely technology and how that interacts with big pharma companies. But from there, I then had a colleague there who we got on very well. We built a lot of stuff together internally, and we then decided to start a company. We were like, right, we can't just keep working for the man, because we could see around us, like you could see around you, your lives unfolding in front of you through the hierarchy within a company. And I was like, yeah, we can't do this.
Like the ghost of Christmas future.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I was like, no, this is not for us. But also we'd been kind of working quite closely on like internal projects. And it was almost like a little co-founding team within a company.
Right.
And we were like, okay, well, hang on, we can build and ship stuff and do things. So let's go and like.
Was that always your intention, or what was the tipping point? Because I'm fascinated by that zero to one piece whereby people are working or people have an idea. That initial, how you close that gap?
Well, I think, I mean, I'd always had the ambition to do something before that. I never quite knew what it was going to be and or whatever it was, but I knew I'd do something at some point. But I think there was probably one particular piece of work we did, and both of us kind of worked on that start to finish, and like effectively shipped a product, right? And it was that point where I was, okay, cool, like we can and should do this, because we knew how much that project was worth to the company. And we're like, yeah, we're not getting paid that, so we should probably go and do some of this stuff ourselves. But then it was like, okay, what do we do? And so we did. And you know, I remember we sat and I was in London at the time, actually was living out at the time. And we just kind of, I'm not sure if we bunked off work or if we actually booked a holiday off work, but the pair of us went into London for the day, went to what we thought was going to be, you know, a conference about CRMs. Which is exciting, right?
Sounds fun, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Except we were a week early, so we actually just went and sat in a bar in Charing Cross. So we sat there for 12 hours, and we just started noting stuff down, like what are we gonna do, blah blah.
Love it.
And like it may have been the next day, or certainly within the next few days, that we both quit, and we were like, let's go do something. And so, yeah, the CRMs was our initial idea. We're going to build this great CRM at that time, because that was kind of a bunch of the internal project we'd done. It turns out that was not a very good idea for us. We also built something called FileZar, I think it was called at the time, which got no customers and was aimed at sharing large documents across organizations. And this was just the same time as Dropbox was launching. Yeah. We should have built Dropbox, right?
Yeah. Well, why didn't you just do that?
we tried a few things out, right? And we were running out of money at that point. And
so talk to me about this, break this bit down, because these are the experiments yeah. piece, and this is where we're trying to move the podcast towards this logistics of doing experiments.
Yeah.
So you quit. What was the plan when you quit?
I'd like to tell you there was a plan.
What was the first
idea? We had enough capital saved up to give us like 6 months of experiments, right?
Yeah.
Trying stuff out and doing that stuff. And so we just poked around at a few different places, you know, did some research. Okay, we Googled a lot of stuff, right, for a while to find something interesting. We had a background in healthcare, kind of, and pharma space. So that was always kind of interesting, but quite difficult to build in. But kind of we were fairly confident. And we knew it was low risk for us at the time. So for me particularly, I was like, listen, it was pre-kids, any responsibilities. So it was like kind of like if we try stuff, it doesn't work, it's fine. Like we'll just go and get another job for a while until we try again. What was good was killing stuff quickly. So we didn't spend too long focused on one thing. We didn't go too deep down the rabbit hole, and we sort of tried a few different ideas at the start, at least thought widely about ideas at the start. And it was actually during that process that kind of my dad is a GP, right? He's he's not retired. And he was like, can you just build me a website for my surgery? And like, I was like, oh, I don't know about that.
I have all these big ideas. I can't just do something normal like that.
And also never do work for friends and family, right? So it's a bad idea. But we started to dig into that, right? It's like, listen, it's like, okay, well, that's interesting that's a necessity for him and that there's not someone doing that. And that's where the whole thing started. So it was like, okay, if there's that need there, then is there a market for this as like a product instead of like a service? And that's what we ended up building. So we built what was effectively like websites for GP surgeries at the start. And that was just a way for people to interact with their patients online. So some of it was just starting off with like just basic website stuff, but then we built in like a patient layer on top of that where you could order your prescriptions and do your appointments and all that stuff. Damn. And the timing was really good in the UK market in particular for this. And so we kind of got, you know, I built one for my dad, but then I built one like kind of, we productized that because the last thing you want to do was like have to do updates all the time. So we built a back end to this and then like managed to kind of sort of sell it to 5 or 6 or 7 customers early on. But it was really hard. Like the sales thing was really hard and didn't really know how to do that. So we'd built this kind of product that we thought was great. It was like, why isn't everyone buying this, right? But it turns out that doesn't work, right? Like they don't just come to you. But we'd also built it probably incorrectly. We'd built it for ourselves. Right. So we built it for like, this is what we think it should look like. And as it turns out, like who is the user in this case? It's the patient, right? Like it's the person who wants to know when it's open, when they can go and get their prescription. So it's like,
that is still one of the biggest bugbears I have about restaurants and cafes.
Okay.
You've just trawled through about 3 different, and they have to download the PDF.
Yep.
Yeah. I just want to know if you're open or not. So,
exactly. Right. So, and so I talked to the kind of early customers of this stuff and they were like, yeah, it's great. But actually, you know, our patients are this and it's quite hard to find this and it's quite hard to do this. So it was like, okay, cool. So then we went back and we kind of re-engineered the product a little bit, right? To make it more focused on the patients. And that was just to make things, in our view, worse, but in their view, better, right? So, and it did work for a little bit and it kind of got us, you know, a few more customers. So we kind of maybe went from 5 to 20, right, over the course of maybe 6 months, right? This was not making us a lot of money. But we saw enough in this to think that actually this was something that could probably afford to pay the rent while we thought of our next idea.
Yeah.
At that point, it still wasn't really like kind of fully functional, like this is going to be a big business or anything. But we still could struggle on the sales side. And so I then spent some time with a few of the early customers. And we had a very interesting, myself and my co-founder had a very interesting relationship where I was technical, but like I'm a very bad developer, and he was an amazing developer. So very early on, we had this kind of demarcation where I wasn't allowed to touch the code and he wasn't allowed to touch the customers, and that was fine. But so I spent some time with the customers then as I went, and I actually went and visited a couple of them, and it became very clear that actually we were targeting like doctors as the customers in here, but that was completely wrong because actually they're busy. They've got to see patients and do house calls and do all this stuff. The person that deals with all of the operations and technical stuff is like what was called a practice manager, kind of like an office manager there who deals with all of the rotas and the HR and the, you know, operations and the finance and the everything. And like, this was just basically another problem for them.
Right? Yeah, you're not making their life easier. You're making it harder. Yeah.
And so I was watching and I was like, okay, so this is interesting. But the only thing they knew how to use particularly well in a technical capacity was Microsoft Office. So, which then we went back and we kind of thought about this and we re-engineered the product for like the third time. And we made the back end of the website look pretty much identical to Microsoft Word.
Brilliant.
So when then they got this, they were like, oh, okay, I can use this. This is not a website. This is like Microsoft Word. So it's like, I can type this thing, I can click save, and it's online. I'm like, yeah. And that's how it works.
Brilliant.
And so they they then turned everything pink, added clip arts, did stuff, and it made it look like horrendous in my view, but it was theirs.
They were using it.
And they told their friends about it and they did the thing. And so we ended up going then from like 20 customers to 40, 80, 120 and built it up then over, it took 5 years of the thing, I think, but I think we ended up with 4,000 or 5,000 customers. Wow. And like we had then all the patient stuff on the top of that. So it's prescriptions and appointments and like test results, all that kind of interactive side of stuff. So we had millions and millions and millions of users who were kind of doing very practical stuff. So it's not the same as kind of now when you've got like whatever, 20 million users, because it's very transactional, right? So it's like you go there for a purpose. So it's not like we've got 20 million daily active users, but we had in the region of like, you know, I think it was 15 to 20 million patients who were then using the system at one point. So it took most of the UK market, and then we sold the company. So it was like got to a point where then we had an acquisition offer for the company and we went through that, and then we sold the company to a big US firm.
How does that come about? How do you, so a lot of stuff there I want to come back and touch
we'll
on.
Come back to as much.
But talk to me about the acquisition, because I think a lot of people say that they're like, oh, then we get bought. But how does that happen? How do you go from like chipping away to like suddenly getting bought?
Yeah, I mean, it actually wasn't planned in any way whatsoever. Like we had no exit strategy. The company that kind of ended up acquiring us, we'd kind of worked with them on something else before. It was kind of relatively small and a partnership thing. But they called us up and said, listen, will you come to their offices, which their European office was in Leeds. And we arrived there and, you know, they were like, listen, you know, we'd like to do a bit more with you. You know, how would you feel about an acquisition? And then, you know, of course, we said no. And then we said no. And it went on a little bit. But we'd kind of been working with them a little bit before. And then, like, after a while, they got to the point where actually, like, it made sense for us.
The number got big enough.
Yep. Yep.
How, I ask everybody this, how did that feel? Did you have an earnout? That's the first question.
Yep.
Okay. So after the earnout, forget that. How did you feel that the day after you walked away?
So the earnout wasn't a significant portion of the deal. So it was more like when the deal closed, how did I feel, as opposed to when the earnout happened, because the earnout happened, I didn't particularly care at that point.
Usually it's the opposite. Usually because people, I always ask them, oh, how did you feel the deal closed? They're like, I felt nothing. I was back at my desk the next day and because I had to do two more years or I didn't get paid.
Yeah, whereas we didn't need to sell the company. Like we didn't raise any capital. It was fully bootstrapped. Oof. It was highly profitable. There was only two of us on the cap table. It was like...
the dream.
So yeah. We had no employees. everything was contracted. So it was, we got to the point where actually we didn't need to sell and we had quite a lot of leverage in the deal then. So that's what we did. And we made sure that the earnout wasn't too big, and they were fine with that. Like to be honest. So it was a very simple acquisition. But I felt, I mean, it was clearly like a life-changing day for me, but it was more, I'd already flipped ahead in my head to what's next rather than what had just happened, because all of a sudden you're presented with a white piece of paper now. It's like, I know I've got an earnout and I know it's only, I think earnout was reasonable. It was only a year, I think. I actually stayed for longer and because it was quite fun doing some of the stuff as well, because part of the earnout was like hand the company over, but then they were, it's a huge US company called Stericycle who mostly deal in taking away clinical waste from hospitals.
No way.
But they couldn't get any bigger because of competition law. And so they were diversifying. And so one of their big diversification was into logistics and technology. And
clever.
So they wanted to set this up, but rather than do it from scratch, they decided they'd buy the market leader in a bunch of different areas and do it. You know, it's a questionable strategy, but they
good
were going
strategy.
With it. It was good for me. But that meant that I was kind of involved in quite a lot of M&A during the year. So it was really interesting. So I was involved right from like leading start to finish on deals to being involved in other stuff. So I enjoyed that part of it, which is why I stayed for longer. But yes, back to your question, how did you feel? Is like, I think it made me look forward rather than back, right? And I thought I was going to be very, you know, emotional about handing a company over, but it turns out I wasn't at all. And I think largely I wanted we pride ourselves in really high levels of customer service, right? So I just wanted to make sure that was going to continue. And as long as the customers were going to keep continuing to get a good service after that, I was pretty comfortable with handing it over. Because I think once you make the decision that you're going to do it, like in your head, you flip almost instantly.
That's really interesting. That's that tends to be the founder's answer, is that just on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You said something really interesting there about creating value. I think people mix that up so much, right? They start I'm going to do this, that, and the other. But they forget about creating value for the customer. And that was really interesting how you'd first of all solve the problem for yourself, which is the classic founder problem. Going, yep. Oh, wouldn't it be cool if, but your customer is like, no, that's not the problem at all. So I think there's a lot of lessons there for founders that before you start building out all the bells and whistles, you just go sit with your customer and literally
even if it's just sitting there watching them. Mm-hmm. So especially if it's not an area you're familiar with, a lot of founders build in kind of like we talked about over lunch, what's cool, new hot space now, you know, everything AI now. You know, they forget that like there's an end user. What is that end user doing? What's their psychology? What's their day? What's their pain points? Like without them, no real good companies get built. And I thought it was really interesting that it was your dad. We often think, oh, this is big strategy. And we have this big idea. Oh, and your brain is literally on fire, smoke coming out of your ears trying to think of the big strategy. When in essence, it nearly always is, well, just start with this one small thing.
Yeah.
This tiny thing and not having an ego to feel, oh, it's just beneath us. Like, you know, it's just, you know, it's not worth doing. It's not worth doing. You might have a pot to piss in and people turn down work because it's not worth doing. But the momentum, I'm a big, big believer in momentum. I talk about it on nearly every episode. Without that momentum, you're not getting to that end goal.
Ideas are just ideas until you do something about them, right? Like, and they will just forever be like that. So like getting going is super important. It doesn't matter what it is, but then also the ability to let go quickly helps a lot, right? Because then you can start a bunch of things as long as you're comfortable with killing a lot of things. And that's the attitude I took to that stuff anyway.
What was your experimental process then? So you'd start, test it, kill it. Talk me through that little stage. How did you run that?
It probably wasn't so process driven at that point. Like it wasn't like we didn't do any rigorous testing or data or anything like that. It was more like kind of we'd start to build something and then think about, well, actually, this is now going to be like a 3-month build if we want to build this big thing out. And like, we let's do some research here and do that stuff. So like there was a method to it, but there wasn't like it wasn't a data driven process, right? Yeah. It was very much intuitive. And it was like, for me, having that co-founder with me was super important, right? I would be a terrible solo founder. There's some very good ones, right? But I'd be a terrible solo founder, right? I would live in my own head and not get anything done. I'd just keep having ideas and not do anything, right? So having that
was great. I hear you.
So having that was great. And then like we had a very good relationship, like very open and like some might say brutally honest relationship sometimes, which was fun.
Talk to me about that, because feedback is very important. Being able to give it and take it. How did you develop that relationship?
I mean, we'd worked together on some things before, so kind of we knew each other, we knew what we were like, and we went into that comfortable with the fact that we could make it work, right? So it was like kind of, we were quite, we were quite complimentary, let's just say, but both of us were pretty direct and pretty honest with each other, and so it was fine. And we actually liked to socialize with each other as well, you know, that was, and that wasn't a necessity for me, but like spending time with each other outside of normal working hours was cool as well, because well, we never really stopped working and talking and thinking, but like it's kind of, it meant that it was quite a pretty real relationship for me. But also then it got to the end of that and Neil, my co-founder was like, he was about 10 years older than me, at the time, probably still is. But at the end, we're coming towards the end of it and do the acquisition. And then it was very clear that we wouldn't do another business together, and not through any badness or any breakdown of relationship. It was just like afterwards we lived different things that we want to do, and that was totally cool as well. So it was
life goes in circles. The thing is, as you get older, you realize there's seasons to everything.
Yeah,
there's a season to every stage of your life, and that's fine, you know. And again, I think it's the founder mentality. You don't pine for the summer just gone.
No,
you just look ahead and go, right, okay, what's the next
season? And I just want to pick up on something else you said as well about that kind of talking to customers thing, because I think it's important, is that I would have short-circuited 6, maybe 8, 10 months of work by doing that customer conversation piece at the start. There's no playbook for doing this. Like you can't build a business through a playbook. You can't just, you know, ABC, got to go talk to this many customers and do this and get the feedback. It doesn't work like that. But you need to talk to enough of them to get enough signal before you get to noise. So it's like, how many people do you talk to at the start? First of all, you got to find the right people. So I first of all found the wrong people. So you got first thing is find the right people. So the people who are actually experiencing the problem that you're thinking about. And then you got to talk to a sample set of them. And I don't think it has to be a huge sample set. Some people will tell you, go talk to 50, 60, 70 people and come back to me and tell me what you've done. I think it's more in the region of 8 to 12. Like, you need to speak to that number of people. That'll give you enough. And it has to be, if you can make it a sort of fairly wide variety of them, and don't be directly connected to them as well, helps sometimes. But that sort of sample size is all you need to give you enough signal to take a step, right? Otherwise, you spend so long in conversations that you just get lost.
Why do people not do this? Because this seems to be the major downfall you see with most startups. They do not get in front of their customers early enough. And similarly, pattern recognition from chatted to hundreds of founders now, the ones that really thrive just get out there so early. We talked about Owen from Tynes there over lunch. 8 weeks he was at market.
Yep.
He was in with his customers. He was testing. Mm. Why do people not do that? Because it seems like the obvious hack. But again, you see the mistake made over and over and over.
Yeah, I think people are not very good at having conversations with potential customers. And there is a way, it's quite a learned skill. Like I was really bad at doing it at the start, you know, and then I got better and better at it. And you can, you know, there's some great resources out to read and that is true. And everyone recommends a book called The Mum Test, which is actually a great book about like how to have a simple customer conversation. But until you actually have like two or three or four of them, you don't get comfortable with them. And so I think people need to just, you have to just do it. Like there's no rationale. It's just like, you have to just really make an active effort to go out and speak to people and try as hard as you can to avoid confirmation bias.
Does fear and ego hold people back from talking to customers?
Fear would hold some people back, I think. Ego, not so much. I think some people, well, it depends. I think ego's a different one, but I think fear definitely does. Like,
are they afraid to hear that that's not the solution there?
Yeah, I think that's the fear bit for me. Is like, I'm afraid to think this idea is not that good. And hence my sort of comment about confirmation bias is people hear what they want to hear and not the truth. And that's why you have to practice this stuff and be very cautious not to use leading questions which, you know, it's like the, what's it called? The X Factor, right? You go on to sing there. Oh yeah. Everyone tells me I'm amazing. Yeah. Right. And as soon as they sing, it's like, not so much. Right.
Yeah. It's wild. I'm fascinated by human psychology.
Yeah,
like,
okay.
You know, why we do the things we do, you know, like clearly talking to customers is a great plan. And then you see it over and over. Oh no, we didn't really talk to that many. We just thought it'd be a good idea. It's fascinating. I think because you short circuit, like you said yourself, probably 6 to 12 months of work.
Yeah.
Just by having, you know, 10 to 12 awkward conversations that will get easier over time. What did you do when you stepped away then? You had the money in your back pocket. What was the next plan? Or did you have a plan?
No, I had no plan whatsoever. I was bored for a little while. I did an MBA for a year, which was interesting.
When was this?
Just after, well, I don't know, 5 years ago, whenever it was.
Well, most people buy a Porsche and they have a midlife crisis. You didn't
MBA. It's weird. I got actually in kind of the you know, startup world, like, right, you know, it's like, it's kind of seen as a pretty negative thing, like, if you've got that. So I don't tell too many people about it. And it turns out I've just told everyone about it right now. So thanks.
A friend of mine went back and did one. And I said, don't do that. Don't do that. And then she went back and she's like, yeah, it's going brilliant. And I was like, I think I might've been wrong. I think you were probably right to do it. And now she's thriving at it and she absolutely loves it. But it's funny. Like,
it helped me do some things actually. So like most of what it was me, you know, arguing with the lecturers for a year because it's, you know, I just come outside of selling the business and, like day one in the MBA. And it's like, here's what we're going to be doing. Excuse me. I have a question. It's like, where's the module on sales? No, nothing about sales there. So I spent a lot of time battling with the theory view practice of this stuff and having arguments, but I actually enjoyed it. Like, I enjoyed doing it. Helped with critical thinking a little bit, like kind of getting back to that level of stuff and doing some
probably give you the space you need, because I've talked to my friend about it and she's like, it's just give me the space to step back and look at other people's businesses and look at models and look at going, well, it doesn't have to be that way. You know, I think when you're so close to it and when you're in the industry for a long time, it can be... You can lose sight of it. You can lose sight of external, what's really happening in the world.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that for sure. There was probably a bit of uncertainty at my end as well, in that I kind of knew I wanted to do something else, but I didn't have a good idea. Mm. Like, I was like, listen, I've got a load of quite average ideas and nothing. And I was like, yeah, I want to do that for the next 5 years. And also the co-founder thing was an issue for me. It's like, actually, I needed someone to work with. And that's not easy to find, right? So kind of someone that you really want to spend the next little while building stuff out. And so I was like, I just didn't leap into it, right? So it's like, I had the luxury of not having to, so that was cool. But yeah, so I didn't.
Was it discomforting? Did you feel a little bit lost? No, you were quite happy just to.
Okay. I was totally happy. Like, it was totally fine, and I had all the time in the world to do whatever I wanted. But I guess maybe the MBA was like plugging a gap, right? But it was more of a intellectual gap than a kind of, you know, more than anything else, and it gave me something to focus on and do for a bit, and that was kind of fun. And it was on the back of that, actually, I wrote a big sort of project as part of that that was about startup ecosystems, right? That's kind of how I ended up where I am now.
Where were you at this? Were you in London, back in Belfast?
Just
back in
Belfast at that point.
What brought you back?
I've been in London for a while, and my wife was probably less settled than I was there, but at the same time, we're both ready to move, and we're like, okay, where are we going to go? And we were like, Glasgow, Edinburgh, London, or Belfast were our four choices, and like we met in Glasgow, so we got a soft spot for Scotland, and I thought that's probably where we'd end up, but then we ended up back in Belfast. I can't really remember the driver of the going back there, but anyway, we ended up there, and my wife got a job there, and like I was free to go and do what I wanted, so that was fine. Belfast was probably bottom of my list at the time of places I wanted to go back to from London, but then when I got back, it was like just a, you know, it transformed
into, really,
kind of, you know, whatever it was, 10 or 12 years that I'd been away,
and
just a totally different place, because I left at the tail end of the Troubles, right, to go to Glasgow and then London, and but going back to the place, like, there was a much better energy, much more positive, more stuff happening. It's like that now. It was great.
And yeah, like I said to you over lunch, I was there 2 weeks ago. I was so impressed. Yeah. I hadn't spent proper time there in a long time.
Yeah.
There's just such a buzz there. There's definitely an energy. You get an energy at certain cities. There's definitely an energy there now. And there's all these kind of cool places opening and nice bars and cafes. Little things like that matter. You know, people want to feel comfortable. They want to feel like this is somewhere I can build a life, not somewhere where I can grow up and leave.
100%. And it is a great place to build a life. And like, you know, I've got a young family and I'm delighted about where I live. And like, there's a lot of stuff going on. And at the same time, you're, you know, an hour's flight away or 2 hours flight away from anywhere you want, or 2 hours on the train down here. And it's like, it's no problems. And it's definitely, the place has transformed from in Northern Ireland has transformed in you know, obviously we're 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement now, and so it's a different place than what it was. And I was really happy I'm really happy I made the decision to go back now. But it wasn't an easy decision at the time, especially when you're thinking about more opportunities, right? So it's like, what's next? It's kind of, and you know, Ireland is small, like North and South, Belfast, Dublin is still small. And so you have to think about bigger, wider opportunities.
What were you thinking? You did the MBA. What were you thinking after that? What was the plan?
Well, I mean, the plan was always to probably start something else and do something else. I thought that would form around people rather than ideas. So I thought that I would kind of start to, you know, meet some people, which I did, and like who were interested in building something. And then that we'd like organically find something that we would get into. And, you know, that didn't happen exactly how I thought, because I then, as I said, I wrote my kind of this project thing, and I sent it off to Tristan Watson, who was the CEO of Ignite, which was kind of this startup accelerator program, not unlike NDRC, that was just setting up in Belfast. And I said, listen, I just did all this research and stuff, and there's some interesting things, you know, please do a good job. And he then asked me to come in and help us, just an EIR in the programs, just kind of help out with accelerator programs and help some founders. And I was like, this is great, right? Because I can pass on some of the stuff that I've done terribly wrong and help some founders coming through. And that kind of sucked me into the world of this stuff a little bit. So there was me and another guy called Chris McClelland, who's now Broadstone VC with Eamon Leonard and Tristan Watson and a couple of others. And we kind of came in and we're like, well, listen, let's start to think about this in a less local mindset and how we can help founders be a bit more global. And it took a little while to get that going. But I think over the course of the 4 years, it went from, you know, having literally nothing invested in these companies to, like, I think it's over 100 million euros now in the portfolio of companies in the 4 years. And that was a government-backed program in Northern Ireland. And it was super successful. In my eyes, it was really successful. I think in the founders' eyes, it was. But then it went to be like, that was great, let's do this again. Sorry, said the government. Brexit happened. We just realized we have no money anymore and we can't do this.
Wow.
So they just stopped it.
Funding gone.
All gone.
Wow.
So they shut it down. And
how much was going into it before that?
Oh, no. nothing. Like, I mean, like there was, this is not, it wasn't a big amount of capital. Like we're talking, I don't know, actually I don't know off the top of my head, but it'll be like a very small amount for Impact Created. So let's say something like 3 million sterling invested to run these things. And like, that was the impact that that was having. But the problem as well is like momentum, right? So kind of it takes a little while to build this stuff. And as soon as you stopped, it's so hard to get it back and going. And like that stopped, COVID hit, you know, there's no executive. And we're getting very Northern Irish about this, sorry, but it's like,
no, but this is the interesting thing. This is why I love doing this podcast, because you can get in and understand things a bit more, because we live 2 hours from Belfast and most people will never spend a day there.
Yeah.
It's wild. Like it's mental. And we really have a lot of the narrative around Northern Ireland is still politics and it's still divisive. Yeah. And you're like you don't understand, like just the narrative is very singular. So it's good to understand what's business like up there. What do startup founders want to do? Like it's so close that there should be seamless. Like it should just be seamless in terms of ideas flow, people flow. You know, that's the kind of the founder mentality. That's the business mentality, and gets hung up on minor decisions on an Excel spreadsheet in Downing Street.
Totally.
Instead of, that's why it's wild. That's why stuff like this is wild.
You can join my movement for Founders Without Borders.
I'm in. Manchester chapter, I'm taking it.
You're right though, founders don't care about borders. They don't care about politics. Like, you know, they need access to network, they need access to capital, you know, and that's it. And there's no reason why that shouldn't, there's no reason why we shouldn't have more of that sort of all island approach to stuff here. Like, why not?
But I think it's like, coming, because, you know, COVID had a massive amount of negativity. We're coming out of it now. But one positive out of it is that people now think broader. I do genuinely think people who I would know working in big companies or, you know, doing standard jobs, they just upped and left.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm heading to Spain for 6 months. Going to do my job over there. Yeah, I'm going to head to Argentina. Yeah, no, I'm going to France. Yeah, I'm going to the US. And they just did it, you know, and they're not founders. So they would have that kind of traditional mentality of like, I got to work 9 to 5. But people just adjust so fast. And I think now that is out of the bottle. People are no longer going to go back to that, you know, rigid, fixed mentality. Some will, but I think the majority, especially founders who are already flexible mentally anyway, I think they'll now go, it doesn't really matter. I will go to where the talent is for a period of time, build maybe for a fixed period of time, and then disperse again, and then come back together again. And we talked about that model over lunch. You're starting to do that now at NDRC.
Yeah, we do that actually during the programs. Yeah, we kind of bring everyone together for kind of a week at the start to kind of get that very rapid exposure and immersion at the start for a week. And then we send everyone away again. And then we come back for another week in the middle of the program and do a similar type of thing and then send everyone away again. And then come back for the final week of the program and bring everyone together for kind of showcase at the end. And it works, right? Because there's a couple of reasons why. It's like, it means you don't have to be in Dublin, right? Which is good for access for everyone in Ireland. But also, as you said, people are building remote teams. We're very much about Irish companies, but like this allows Irish founders to be flexible, because sometimes you need to be near your customers. Sometimes
you stuff. You can have an Irish DNA.
100%.
Right, you can have an Irish DNA. We talked about Owen from Tynes earlier.
Good example.
There's a billion-dollar company and not like a unicorn, fluffy valuation. There's a real company being built here with an Irish DNA. Their customers are all over the world. You know, you don't have to be so rigid in the thinking of, oh, it has to be based in Dublin. It has to be here. You know, some of it can be, some of it might not be. Some, you might come here for 3 months and go abroad for 9. It doesn't have to be quite so rigid. I think if we move away towards a more fluid thinking, it'll benefit everybody.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And from my perspective as well, it's like just from a purely practical level and how we can help founders, I think having that hybrid format allows you to, so one thing we don't have here is like a lot of experience in scaling companies. So it's like we've got a lot of stuff at the early stage, quite well supported that stuff, we have no experience. So like, how do you gain that experience is you have to kind of import it at the start until it becomes part of it. And the way you do that is you get people from other places that have been and done this stuff that will help, will come back, they'll give their time, they'll speak to Irish founders, they'll do the stuff. So by making it a hybrid program, what we do is enable that stuff to be delivered remotely. So we kind of get this core weeks in person and then this other stuff that gets from, you know, quite often from the US and the West Coast. And like, you know, we had David Singleton from the CTO of Stripe on, just to kind of, he gave his time to the founders because he could, right?
And I love that.
If it was like in person for a week, we don't get that. So
exactly.
So there's a real benefit to doing it from my point of view.
Well, I think my biggest bugbear with the Irish startup scene for so long was that you had all these people who never had run anything in their life mm-hmm. were advisors.
Yes.
Fucking advisors. And all they were doing was lead funneling in for their accountancy practice and mm-hmm. or their advisory practice. And you're like going, toxic. And then yep. they're taking shares and then they're taking equity. And you're like, absolute piranhas mm-hmm. sucking the life out of companies, giving them awful advice, having never run a company in their entire life themselves. So like, I think there's a real shift towards people like yourselves now who have industry experience, who go, this is how it really is. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you have a problem with scaling. Okay, we're going to get the best in the world yep. to tell you how that is. Not like Jimmy, who's me mate from the golf club.
Yeah.
But that mentality, you know, old male, pale, stale, like that mentality was entrenched for a long time within Ireland, not just in the ecosystem here, but within Ireland itself. That's how things get done. Whereas I think of the sporting analogy whereby, you know, they bring in the best players in the world. Doesn't matter where they're from.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what their background is. They bring them in to form the best team in the world. Mm-hmm. I think that's how we need to think about startups.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's how we think about that. Like, it's like kind of, when you think about, like, every time I finish like running a cohort or a program, so it's like, where were we bad there? How can we make this better next
time? Love that.
Like, yeah. It's like literally like, what was wrong with this? How did we do this? And I, you know, I do annoy the founders afterwards. Like, just leave me alone, would you? But it's yeah. like, no, like, cause we got to make it better and better and better. It's like, and it's bringing in, like, I'm absolutely not the best person in the world to talk to all founders. It's like, but I know that. And I know that when there's a particular problem with something, I will be able to find someone that is the best person to deal with that stuff, and I'll connect them. Like, and that's probably one of the best things we could do is just be connectors of people. And that's fundamentally, I think that is what the point of an accelerator program is like, it is just a super network and you get plugged into that network and it's up to you how you take advantage of that. But I won't, you know,
exactly.
I won't turn down introductions. I will put you in front of the right people as long as you're coming at me with the right questions. So it's, I think that's one thing that we're trying to do is to keep raising the level, keep raising the standard of this so that we can make more founders more successful.
I love that. Right. Let's dig into it.
Okay.
What do you look for in a founder? that secret sauce. What is that?
What do I look for in a founder? So it's more like, what do I look for in a startup than a founder is kind of like, yes, it can be founder, but I'm kind of interested in teams and dynamics as much as the individual founders. But the two things that are super important is like that, first of all, like I'm operating in primarily a world of venture track companies, rightly or wrongly, but that's what we operate in. And so therefore I've got to think about this in terms of like, okay, well, what does a good venture backed company look like at this point in time?
So what does a good venture-backed company look like at this point in time?
There's only two things that really matter.
Right? I'm going to nail you down on this one.
No, that's okay. I'm getting there. Market opportunity is the first thing, right? So because if you're going to take venture capital, the market opportunity is going to have to support that. Now, I don't particularly like people who come in and say, oh, yeah, this is a $5 billion market and we're going to get 1% of it and therefore it'll be fine, right? Like, no.
So obvious. Yeah, makes sense.
But the market just has to be like interesting and the founder has to be able to point a path to where this could turn into something big, right? So everyone gets the market wrong at the start. Like nobody actually ends up building what they think they're going to build generally. So it's like, but the market's got to be interesting and have the capacity to sustain like a venture track company in there. And then the second thing is like, can this team execute into that market? So do they have the right ingredients to be able to get to just the next stage of this company building? And that's how, those are the only two things really that matter when I'm making these kind of investment decisions at an early stage. But in both of those cases, or with just taking those two things into consideration, I will always over-index on team. So it's like, markets change, all that stuff. Team doesn't change. Mm. Right? So it's like we're over-indexed on the team at that point. So, you know, how do you identify a good team in there? There's no formula. It's like, you know, Google did that big study. What was it called? Aristotle, mm-hmm. where they tried to find what a perfect high functioning team was across their, you know, 18,000 employees at the time. And they could find no patterns whatsoever.
Yeah. So, I read that. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it was interesting.
It's part science, right? But your job is to be a talent spotter, essentially.
Yep.
You know, you have to sit there and sift through, I'm sure, hundreds, if not thousands of applications. Pick, how many do you pick?
We do about 13 or 14 a year of investments.
Okay, so that's a small number of a huge volume.
Yep.
How do you filter that down quickly?
It's more art than science, right? Yeah. At that point, it is. And generally, I can see very early on the people who are, they really want to build this. Like, they're not startup tourists. They're not just like, I want to do a startup. They're like, I've know what this is. I have lived this problem, or I have a unique angle on what is an existing like problem over here, or I disagree. Generally, like, people who can over explain this really well. So like, if I'm looking at like an application form that I try to make very simple with this stuff, but like, how, like, often people who answer the question, why now is the right time, well, are good founders. So because they've taken a bunch of different stuff into account at that time. So they're like, okay, well, they've understood that this market opportunity is now going from here to there. They've understood that the macroeconomic situation looks like this. They've understood that these competitors are doing this. So if they can explain the why now really well, they tend to have a very good understanding of like what they're building and how they can build it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
What is a startup tourist? Because I got a good giggle out of that.
Someone who wants to be a founder, right? Like, someone who's like, this is great. I'm going to go raise money and be a founder and I'll go to all these events and turn up and hello. But actually, like, they can't explain the problem, talk about it in a good way, explain how they're going to go from A to B, just say, yeah, it's all going to be fine. I've got this idea for, like, generally. Okay. A good one is when I get a call or an email or something, I say, I've got an idea for an app.
Yeah.
Right.
That's that wasn't a good idea 10 years ago when apps were a good idea.
But that still happens, right? And sometimes it's like naivety, actually. So kind of 1 out of 10 will actually be a good idea, right? Because it's just that they don't speak the startup parlance.
Yeah, it's not an app, it's just a website.
Yeah.
But it's not even a website, it's a feature on someone else's website. But
it happens, and people get sucked in because there's you know, there's a buzz around the space as well, and people want to get pulled into it. And like, yeah. I can kind of understand that, but at the same time, like, I have to be very realistic with what I'm trying to do, but what we're trying to do, and as I have to say no pretty directly and pretty forcefully a lot of the time.
How do you give good feedback? How do you tell them no, but give them good enough feedback that it's useful?
Well, I try to talk to everyone as I know to, so which is difficult with the number of applications that we go through, but because I think it's important. So I think there are too many people who build the wrong thing for too long, and because, maybe back to confirmation bias that we talked about earlier, but actually because like they just keep hearing what they want to hear, and actually sometimes it's like I feel a sense of responsibility to say, I don't think this is an opportunity personally, or I don't think this is a venture opportunity is maybe the right way to phrase it for me. And I think you should go away and think about these three things and maybe come back to me. And if I can help you with something, please like get in touch. So it's like kind of, I think it pays to be pretty honest and direct most of the time with the feedback.
Has anyone ever taken it very badly?
Oh, yes. Yes. And that's fine. I get complaints and all the time about various things. So when we announce a cohort for whatever it is, like kind of there's 400 people that didn't make it on there, right? So some of which will send me an email and tell me why they're better than the five of the companies that we've selected. And
you'll be sorry when we're worth a billion,
yeah,
Ian.
Maybe. And like, maybe they'll be right, and that's fine. You know, you can't be perfect at this stuff. And I hope I'm wrong a bunch of times, and I hope people are, you know, do well. But like, ultimately, it's decisions you've got to make quite quickly. And to be fair, like, it's quite difficult, right? Kind of because you're trying to pick quite a small number of companies from quite a high number of applications. And so like the margins between that are very small, and they can be super subjective, right? So it's, which is why, you know, I don't get to make the decisions. It's like kind of, we bring 10 or 12 people in to to make the decisions on that point. And then I make the decisions.
And then I tell them why they're wrong and then I pick the ones I want anyway. Has there any, I know you're not doing it that long yet, but has there been any where you're like, no, that's an awful idea. And then 24 months later, you're like, oh shit.
I think through my NDRC is a bit early, right? Yeah. So it's like kind of, I don't...
We'll sit down again in 2 years' time.
Ask me back in 2 years whenever someone, you know, I've rejected, of which there's loads of people, they're now, you know, billion-dollar companies.
So if you're listening and you have been rejected by Ian, please do get in touch with Gary at MrGaryFox.com. Only with success stories. Don't rant at me.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I can't think of any, like, you know... So some of the venture firms are quite good at putting their anti-portfolio online of people they passed on and like they've gone on to be really successful.
I love it. Yeah,
it's really good. Bessemer doing a great job of that. And
we had Brian Caulfield on and he was damn honest.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, it's so like good. I missed it, right? And that's cool. Because that's what you learn as well. If you're particularly from the investment side, right? It's like, and we are like investing, but we're not a venture fund, right? Like we're not living or dying by the investment decisions. We want to see return on capital, but it's not like we're not pushing and pushing and pushing in the ventures fund. So we're probably going to miss out. And sometimes we have to make decisions that aren't purely economic, right? We're trying to support people. We're trying to support regions. We're trying to support Ireland. And so the rationale is not just economic for us, right? So, but yeah, I'll have a think about the anti-portfolio a bit.
How do you spot trends and not fads? We spoke briefly about this over lunch in terms of, you know, first it was blockchain, then it was crypto, now it's AI. And suddenly everyone's got an AI. I was at an event, I said this to you already, I was at an event a few weeks ago, probably 70% of the companies in the room were AI backed. I'm like, I know you're definitely not. I know you. I know what you're building and you're definitely not AI backed, but suddenly they latch onto this thing because they feel, oh, this will get me the investment I need. So how do you, as someone whose job it is, how do you spot, yes, this is a fundamental shift in the landscape versus this is a fad that'll blow off in 3 months?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's difficult, right? I remember back to the, you know, messenger bots of about 10 years ago that was going to be the next big thing. But as it turns out, you know, they weren't great. And here we are, you know, full circle again. And we've got, you know, messengers again.
It's so interesting.
But like, if I just do a comparison of like two of those things, so kind of Web3 and where we are right now, I think I think Web3 is interesting. I'm not really bullish or bearish on it. I'm kind of a bit neutral. I think there's a bunch of interesting people working in the space on it, and particularly around sort of payments and infrastructure. But none of the big tech companies invested heavily into crypto or crypto infrastructure, or they do that. And those are some smart companies who are thinking about like 5-10 year horizons, maybe more longer than that. And as soon as the sort of explosion of AI happened sort of in the last few months, it's like they have all gone heavily in. Like they're all investing, you know, billions and billions of dollars. They're investing a lot of time and resource into this space, which is enough of a signal to me that this is not just a fad. This is something that they believe is going to shift. Like it could be the next computing paradigm. Now, you can get too far ahead of yourself in this stuff because it's still super early. But I think we don't really know what's going to happen here. We don't know how long it's going to take, but it is really interesting, right? And the amount of creativity you're seeing with this stuff almost instantly means that there are for sure going to be huge companies built in this space. But it feels like such an early bet to kind of invest in those companies right now. So I don't know how that's going to go, but certainly I think, you know, I would be surprised. Like we're looking for our next cohort at the minute, which means like applications are open. I'd be very surprised if there weren't a load of people who are using this in some capacity. Some will be good, some will be bad, but there should be some that are interesting enough in there. Like, what does it look like for, you know, a big enterprise to have, you know, an AI platform layer in the middle of all the stuff they got right now? I don't know. Will that be a thing? I don't know. But the people that can think about this and think about this in slightly different ways and maybe then utilize some of that AI to kind of create something totally new will be really interesting. I actually think it's kind of the kind of vertical use of this stuff's gonna be really good. So kind of working within niches, within industries, and people with domain experience in there, and then at a level. So there's any number of use cases in here. So distinguishing between the two, I think like it's more because I can see the, you know, the market as such has moved massively in this direction, where with crypto it didn't. It was a speculative market that moved in that direction, whereas this feels real.
Interesting. You you mentioned there your cohort's open. Just give a quick explainer of what that is, just in case people are listening and they're like, oh, that's me. I should be applying for that. What is that?
So we are looking for, you know, 6 or 7, you know, high growth companies or potential high growth companies. There's a kind of early, got to have a sort of product either in market or pretty close to market. Got to be Irish companies, and we are looking for 7 of those to join a cohort. We will invest 100K in each of the companies, and we will help you, like, well, first of all, we'll take your business apart in the first few weeks, and then we'll help you put it back together again.
Make you cry, then give you a hug and tell you it's going to be okay.
And then, you know, hopefully, like, kind of help you, like, with that first phase of getting off capital. And generally, it's open for companies that are going to try and raise their first round of capital in the next sort of 6 to 9 months.
Have companies raised before they come to you, or is this pre-raised? Or what stage?
Some of them have, like, most of them have not, but some of them have raised a small sort of angel round or something beforehand, but that shouldn't be a barrier to anything. Like, we'll happily take, you know, I don't want companies to too far on, and because actually we can't help you at that point, and you shouldn't be on a program at that point. You should be, you know, off building your business.
Yeah.
So it's like really for that soup, that kind of early stage, like not like, we won't take companies who are just an idea generally at this point, right? They've got to be some, it's highly competitive. There's going to be 400 plus applications for only a handful of places. So like generally you've got to be a little bit further along and have product in market or be close to it, right? Some of them haven't quite had product in market, but that's because they've been maybe, you know, spin-outs or longer R&D phases or whatever. But like, they've got to be pretty far down the funnel where they're going to be able to raise capital in the next 6 to 9 months.
What's the application process?
Go to ndrc.ie and hit the apply now.
Simple.
I've tried to cut back a lot of the application form, you know, process, but good tip. Answer the why now question well.
If they haven't picked up on that already, I can't help them. You see the cream of the crop, right? You see hundreds, if not thousands, of applications every year. If you were going to start a new business in the morning, what area would that be in? Because they sense there's still something in you, there's still a spark in there. What would you start it in?
What would I start the next business in? I don't know. I'm very interested in the education space. And I think that's probably I've got more interested in that since, you know, I've got 3 young kids now. And particularly since, like, I feel education in Northern Ireland is one of the big things that's holding it back. But like, that's not a place to build a business. And so it's like, how do I take some of that interest in education and like apply that to what might be an interesting business opportunity? So I think more towards the, you know, that third level gap between university and job is actually not very well catered for at the moment. And I think there's a bunch of interesting things that could be done around there that could be pretty commercialized. But I'm also very conscious that, like, I get sucked into this bubble as well. And like, it's very easy to think, oh, well, that's not a $1 billion opportunity, so I can't do that. And I'm like, well, actually, like, my last company was not venture backed, and if I do another business, like, will it be venture backed? Well, maybe not, but it shouldn't limit my way of thinking about what I'm going to do. And kind of back to the last bit that we had was like, where's AI going to affect stuff? And that's interesting, but like, for me, it's going to be a lot of verticals. Like, you know, my last business was a vertical. I think there's still massive untapped opportunity within small verticals, and small verticals might be 20 million, 30 million pound businesses, right? And so, like, I don't have a good answer for where the next one's going to be, but it's going to probably be something in that space where it's like within a vertical, and hopefully built on top of some new and fun stuff.
It's an exciting time.
Yeah.
I think it's a special time. I think there's really something exciting happening in the world. I just feel that there's something bubbling up. I agree with you on the education space. I do a lot of work with Trinity and third level educations or educational facilities, and I think there definitely is something between an apprenticeship versus some gap that gets you out of college and into an actual job, because now with everything being hybrid and remote, there's going to be a drop off there between what you've learned in college versus what you're getting taught. If you're sitting at home in your bedroom and you go from school in your bedroom, college in your bedroom, work in your bedroom, that rounding out of skills, where does that happen?
Yep.
It has to happen somewhere. So I think there's ample room in the education space for something new.
Yeah, I agree.
And what's old is new again, right? You talked about it there, like apprenticeships. Years ago, that's what everyone did, apprenticeship builder, apprentice carpenter, apprentice mechanic.
Yep.
And then they went out again. Mm-hmm. Versus like, no, go sit in the classroom for 4 years and then come out and then we'll teach you. You know, so I think there's definitely somewhere between an apprenticeship and a college degree that there's definitely a magic there, especially for people who are want to build companies or want to have actual technical skills. So yeah, it's fascinating as to what that is. Even another program I just want to shout out because it's a really interesting thing and hasn't been done here in Ireland I've seen before, the Founders Program.
Yeah, that's super exciting. So yeah. So that's what, you know, I think I've talked a little bit about like having a co-founder was so important for me. And like, if you're, you know, wanting to do something and maybe like, well, if I give Y Combinator as an example, actually, so if their companies they've invested in, of their 100 most valuable companies, only 4 had a solo founder. Right. So it's like, if you just want
I only was studying this last week, actually. I was going through some of their stuff. We had Protex on and I kind of read around some of the guests either before or after. And I was looking up all the Y Combinator stuff. Yeah. And I'm kind of thinking about new things I want to pursue in the future. And I'm like, I would definitely have someone, a yin to my yang, as we talked about there. I would have someone a complete opposite to me.
Yeah.
Who would just drive it on. I'm definitely more ideas, definitely like thinking.
Yeah.
And then just want somebody who's just like driving.
Yeah. And so for me, having a co-founder is important and it's really hard to find one, right? Like, so it's like, if you're, you know, well, how to find a co-founder is like, you kind of go through your social circle and your professional circle. And like, you know, if there's the right person at the right time in their lives to do that thing that has the right skill set, it happens, right? It's like, it's very difficult. Like
a lot of stars have to align.
A lot of stars,
because this is a 10 minimum 10 year project.
Yeah, it could be.
Realistically, you have to think about it on that. And you have to both, Dee Coakley from Boundless did a really good job of explaining this to me of how she found a co-founder and like how they both sat down at the very start and went, what do you want?
Yeah.
Because I want this. Is that what you want? Okay, well, I think this. What if that? And they hashed it out before they even started. I thought that was beautiful because there's there's so much in Ireland about it. Asher, look, it'd be grand. Don't worry about it. And then 3 years down the line, everyone's murdering each other.
Yep.
I definitely don't give startup advice. I definitely try not to give advice to founders. The only thing I say to them is, have a really clear chat with each other before you start.
Yeah, and that'll be core to that kind of sort of founders program. And then like what we're trying to do with that is to create something from nothing, right? To take a bunch of, you know, ambitious and skilled people and put them in a room together for 3 months and try and get them to create companies and co-founding teams out of nothing. Like I'm probably expecting about 50% of the you know, if you're thinking about this, is like we're like looking to build something sizable and tangible on the back of it, right? So therefore, like that leans heavily towards building software companies.
Of course.
So that's going to be core to it. So therefore, you need a chunk of the pie chart that'll have to be engineering talent, which is totally cool because, you know, we've got a lot of inbound for that. But one of the great things about founders is open to anyone. That other 50% of the pie chart can be anyone, right? And I'd love to see people from outside the startup bubble, outside the kind of core group of people to get involved in that with more diverse ideas and like challenges to take on. And like, you know, someone that has a different experience to me is going to have a better understanding of like the education space than I do, right? And a different angle to that stuff. So I think the more people that we can get from a sort of diverse way of thinking into that is going to be great. So yeah, the whole point is like to put like 45 to 50 people in a room for 3 months. We'll pay them $2,000 a month for 3 months just to be there and try and come up with this. And then if they can form teams around ideas, you know, we will invest in between 5 and 8 teams, 100,000 into 5 of the 8 teams at the end of that period, and then help them get off the races. That's the plan.
I think it's magic. I was on to DC with this. I was like, document the shit out of that.
Yeah, it's a Netflix series waiting to happen, right?
Get someone like Ben on board and get it happening because that would be document gold. Like, there's worse things on Netflix. Yeah. I watch worse things all the time and I enjoy them. I'm like, there's definitely a TV show. There's definitely, even if you just do it yourselves and have it on YouTube as a series, as an MVP, listen, hear me out here. This is my pitch. As an MVP, you got to have a YouTube series in this. You got to start off documented going at the start. Here they are coming in, the before. Oh no, they've all fallen out the middle. The hero's journey, right?
Oh, the hero's journey.
And then
journey.
The music starts to play. The soft music starts to play. We'll do an little slow-mo and then bang, you get one.
I'll sign you up.
Done. We're in, right? Netflix. I'll do the pitch to them. I'll just repeat that to them.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to do a quick fire round.
Okay.
I'm going to wrap up on a quick fire round.
Perfect.
What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
Right now, So it changes for me, right? So there's, I like different books at different times. But right now, Only the Paranoid Survive by Andy Grove.
Love that. Great recommendation. If you wrote a book, what would the title be?
Founders Without Borders.
Nice. We're off 2 for 2 here. Get more serious now. What have you sacrificed to achieve what you've achieved?
Time and experiences, probably more than anything else, I think, would be my answer to that. So I've given up opportunities to do, so opportunity cost, right, of doing something rather than something else. So I think I sacrificed some time with like friends and things early on when I was building the company, and I'm fine with that, right? So it's like kind of, but again, I don't regret any of it.
Okay. If I give you 10 million euros today, what would you spend it on?
10 million euros. I would actually, I think I would write 50K checks into whatever that is in 10 million euros thing. I would index on talent early and try and get more people to start companies.
I love that. That's a good one.
Nice. Basically let them quit their job, right?
Yeah.
Just to go do that. And just do it for as many people as I could.
I like that. That'd be a great experiment. Let's start running. Let's get a fund together. We're launching another fund as well. We already launched another launch. That's top secret until next year. We can't keep that. We have a big launch on that due next year, right? With two funds set up. If you weren't a founder, what would you be doing?
Trying to become a professional golfer.
Oh, we'll talk about that when we wrap up this pod. I'm in bad need of some lessons. I got to play at a charity thing on Saturday. I have not swung a club since my birthday on February 3rd. And before that, I hadn't swung a club since last October. New baby means not a lot of golf. No, yeah. So
young kids mean not a lot of golf. So
I'm gonna get some tips off you. Okay. If I give you 1 million euro today, who or what would you invest that in?
I'd invest it in Patch.
What is Patch? What Patch is? No, I do not know.
Patch is like this six or eight week program in the summer where 16 to 22 year olds come together and try and build stuff. And it's like backed by Stripe and a bunch of people who back this. And these kids are amazing. Like, so they're.
Is it an Irish thing?
Based in Dogpatch every summer.
Okay.
And so they come in and they like pair up and try a couple of ideas and try and build things over the summer. Like last year I came in and there were four of them taking apart a microwave to try and build a hand sanitizer. These are super interesting and smart kids. And I think like if you use that million, just invest it in that, like I think you'd do better than all the venture funds in Ireland.
I had a tweet about 3 months ago and I said, I'm going to, again, another fund.
Yeah.
I'm going to start a fund and invest in every winner or every finalist of the BT Young Scientists.
They're all in Patch.
Well, you think about it. It's Stripe, Protex, Shane Kern.
Yep.
You would be, we'd be comfortable. Me and you wouldn't be sitting here. We'd be sitting in Monaco, right?
It's fund number three for the day and neither of us would be.
I found my new co-founder. This is brilliant. What do you believe that other people would strongly disagree with or find strange?
I don't have a good answer for this, I think is my honest thing. I think my unfortunately my answer comes back to like politics rather than sort of startup related stuff. And like, I ultimately think Brexit will be fine. Right. And everyone else thinks it'll be a total disaster. And I think it'll be fine. But the problem is it might take 15 years to be fine.
It's a great answer. Lovely. That'll get a lot of engagement in the comments.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So it's Ian Brown at NDRC. Yeah. Right. If you could have anyone as a co-founder, who would you want?
My last co-founder.
Oh, that's beautiful. Sound very good answer. And finally, what is your one final bit of advice you'd give to every single entrepreneur listening?
I think I have to go back to what I did wrong is like go talk to 8 to 10 people. Like that is the best thing you can do from an early, at the very early stages for that. That's the best thing you do is talk to 8 to 10 people. Plus get a dog.
My dog's my best pal.
Oh, really?
I would strongly agree with that.
It kept me sane during the process. I used to have to take the dog out walking every day and it was really good for me. So like those are the two things.
He's my best pal. We're going on holidays to Spain this year for the first time with him because we can bring him on the ferry. You can bring him in the cabins now. So that is how much I love my dog. We've orientated our entire life around him.
Well, that was a total sycophantic answer for the host then.
You played right into me. You've looked at my Instagram well. He's on it every single day. Ian, that was a genuine pleasure. Thank you so much. You've been so honest and been so open with your advice and your story.
Cool. Thank you, Gary.
I hope you enjoyed that pod today. wherever you're listening, whether it's Spotify, YouTube, or Apple. Click like, hit subscribe, and I'll see you in the next one.